Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna Padgiri, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Binshu. Binshu is an associate professor of sociology at Emory University. His research and writing interests lie at the intersections of culture and politics. His current research areas are collective memory, civil society, and politics of disasters. He's the author of three books, The Politics of Compassion, The Sichuan Earthquake and Civic Engagement in China, Stanford University Press, 2017, which won two prizes from the American Sociological Association, Chairman Mao's Children, Generation and the Politics of Memory in China, Cambridge University Press, 2021, and The Culture of Democracy, A Sociological Approach to Civil Society, Polity, 2022. His articles appear in leading sociological and China studies journals. In today's conversation, we will be discussing his recently published book, The Culture of Democracy, A Sociological Approach to Civil Society, published by the Polity Press in 2022. I'm so glad to have you here. Welcome to this interview.
Thank you very much for having me.
Right. So let me begin by asking you your main motivation behind writing this book.
So this goes back to my first book, which you mentioned, The Politics of Compassion, The Sichuan Earthquake and the Civic Engagement in China, so which is about a huge wave of volunteering and the civic engagement after the Sichuan Earthquake in 2008. So after that book was done, so the book was mainly a cultural sociological study of volunteering under authoritarian regime. So after the book was done, I felt that, well, there are lots of studies from cultural sociological approach to civil society, but it should have been a book about cultural sociology of civil society, a survey book, so which can provide a manual for researchers and also a textbook for advanced undergraduate students and graduate students seminars. So that was basically the theoretical motivation. Another motivation is that after the first book was done, so I was observing a lot of pressing issues around the world, and particularly Hong Kong's protests from 2014, which was dubbed the Umbrella Revolution, and then to 2019, which was even bigger, that is anti-extradition law protest in 2019. So Hong Kong used to be the so-called offshore civil society in China, and which means that it as a special administrative region, it has some, you know, relatively independent status in China. So many of the activists and organizations sought help from the activists and organizations in Hong Kong. They also published commentaries in Hong Kong news media, which were not able to be published in China. So it's more like an offshore civil society for China. But during the protests and then later the crackdown on the protests and the Hong Kong's status as a relatively independent city declined, and even now it's, you know, as many people said, that Hong Kong is becoming another Chinese society. So that demise of a civil society actually shocked me and made me to think about many issues related to civil society and democracy, and also in other places, such as in the United States, after 2016 election, Trump administration, and ultra-right wing political forces, in not only in the United States, but also in Europe as well. So all these issues stimulated me to think about what is democracy and what is civil society, how we as sociologists can have a better view or a new perspective on civil society. So that was mainly the sort of empirical motivation for me to write this book.
Right. So how do you think the book justifies its global and interdisciplinary approach? If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the book itself is very global and very interdisciplinary, as you said. I designed the book to be written in that way, mainly because civil society itself is a very interdisciplinary field, not only in sociology, but also in political science, political theory, anthropology, public administrations, organizational studies, and all these disciplines have their scholars working on civil society. And also you have fields like so-called third sector research, which is an interdisciplinary field, which hosted a lot of civil society researchers. And also civil society is a very global. I use civil societies in plural form because, you know, you have tons of civil societies in different nation states. The term itself, civil society, was originated in the West, especially in the intellectual history since the Enlightenment, and revived after the democratization of the Central and the Eastern European socialist countries. But civil societies in practice existed long before the term became popular in the late 20th century. So it was a practice. It was a form of society that already existed before the revival. And now civil society is even more global because of the development in communication technology, in transportation, international travels. And so we have lots of international NGOs, and we have global public sphere, which is the discursive space for many people with different languages to participate in discussions of public issues. And also we have people's imagination of the world as a global world instead of just a world based only within national boundaries and the territories of states. So that was the sort of justification of a civil society. And also I'm not entirely satisfied with many of the texts on civil societies because most of them are about the West, and not really so much from the global South or non-Western countries. So I deliberately use a lot of cases from China, from India, from Latin America, Middle East, and from Africa and those places where usually scholars do not actually pay a lot of attention to civil societies, but civil society existed in many ways in those non-Western places. So in this sense, I believe the book actually justifies its global perspective.
Right. So then my next question would be to know a little more about the kind of theoretical as well as the methodological framework that you have used in your book.
Mm-hmm. So I explicitly adopt cultural sociology as the main theoretical framework, especially based on a few basic concepts of culture. So first is the culture in structure, which includes values, symbols, and ideas about civil society and democracy. So it's in the cultural structure. It is there in the narratives, in the ideas. But when people are actually doing civil society, participating in civil society practices and activities, such ideas are realized in their actions. They are likely to change, or people selectively use some of them, not others, according to different situations. So this is the second concept of culture, that is culture in action. And the third concept of culture is culture in interaction. That is culture as the norms of interaction formed in people's actions in civil society activities. For example, how do you treat people with different ideas and opinions? And how do you include people who are less represented in civil society and the public sphere? So the openness and also the inclusiveness are all about these culture. And the last one is less studied, but also studied to some extent in many studies, that is the cultural objects, such as memorials, novels, movies, and writings, and these tangible objects, which are produced by certain cultural producers and received by audience. So all these four concepts of culture form the main theoretical framework for me to use in the book. I tend to have a more inclusive attitude toward these culture instead of using only one of them as my main concept. I include a lot of studies from different perspectives, and sometimes I would say that all these culture concepts are not really congruent with each other. For example, when an organization pursues democratic values, but their activities might follow a norm of interaction, which is quite the opposite to democratic values. When they, for example, if their values are about openness and inclusiveness, but their internal culture is very authoritarian, that actually happens in many, many cases. And also people participating in public activities to pursue the public good, but use individualistic language. It's about me, about my family, instead of about public good. So the purpose of using this kind of individualistic language to pursue public good could be, they want to make themselves look less like saints, but ordinary people, to convince people that, we are authentic individuals instead of people who just talking big, it's imposing their values on other societies. So anyway, so that's basically the theoretical framework I use in my book.
Right. So again, if you could tell us a little bit more about how you define the culture of democracy, which is central to the book, and how it is related to the civil society.
Okay, good. So this is at the heart of this book. First, I want to say that we need to define democracy. In other words, what actually is democracy in civil society? So lots of previous concepts of democracy used in civil society research is mainly focused on democracy as the institution, as the system. For example, electoral system, checks and balances among different divisions of power and rule of law and so on and so forth. All these institutional aspects of democracy. But I would follow John Dewey to view democracy as a form of social life. In other words, democracy could also mean democratic social life. It could also mean how people talk to each other. So that's about deliberation, right? To solve problems. And democracy also could mean associational life, how people organize themselves and to improve the society. So it's about democratic social life. If we start from here, democracy means democratic social life, and then we can actually redefine democracy in a way that is a little bit far away from the prevalent concept of democracy as electoral system. So the culture of democracy refers to values above democratic social life, for example, such as equality, openness, mutual respect, inclusiveness, and so on. And also it could be people's imagination of a democratic society. What is a good society? What is a democratic society? And also it could mean democratic norms of their interactions, whether they realize those values in their interactions, treat people with equality, with respect, and include many people in their civil society activities. All of these aspects of democracies are involved and realized in their effort to build a better society. Although sometimes they may not use the term democracy in some contexts. So I believe this concept of culture of democracy can correct some problems in the literature of civil society. For example, some people use democratic institution as the end of civil society. If civil society is not leading to democratization or building a better democratic institution, and then the civil society is useless. So that was actually very prevalent in the literature on authoritarianism transitioning to democracy. If civil society does not actually play a critical role, and the civil society is useless. I would say this kind of thinking is problematic if we define democracy as a democratic society. I would say a democratic society is the end in itself rather than a means to a political system. And therefore, even under a mature, consolidated democratic system, the civil society could also change toward on democracy, and there could also be a lot of problems as we witness in this world. So there is also a need to develop a democratic society in those countries with consolidated democratic systems. The other side of this coin is that even under undemocracy, and there's a possibility of democratic social life, this is why so many activists are still pursuing civil society and participating in association life, even under authoritarianism. So the culture of democracy remains the most influential part of the culture of civil society. So if you ask people involved in civil society actions why they're involved or observe how they interact with each other, and they will tell you that it's about democracy, although they're not using the word democracy. They probably would say, well, public good, about openness, about inclusiveness, about all these values about democracy. And you see the some basic elements in their expressions and their understandings of their actions. Even though some such influence is most visible when democracy is under threat. In other words, when democracy is contested and challenged, and you see that the values and the culture of democracy are more than visible to others. This is why people worry about democracy, worry about rise of some of the sectors in the societies, which could be the threat to democracy, and worry about disinformation and so on and so forth. So yeah, I want to say the culture of democracy is not all the cultures in civil society, but it's very essential to civil society.
Right. Also, what do you think would be the relationship between civil society and the public sphere?
Well, the relationship has been debated by many scholars. Of course, you find different answers to this question from different scholars. But I try to avoid the debate by defining the public sphere as the discursive space. In other words, a space that could be social or could be physical or could be both for people to communicate with each other. So it's all about communication. It's all about discourse. And civil society itself is a bigger concept, broader concept than the public sphere, because it also includes associations and individuals' actions, while the public sphere, in my definition, is about discourses. So that's basically my conceptualization of the relationship between civil society and public sphere.
Right. So, of course, we talk a lot about the political aspects of civil society, but in your book, you also look at its cultural aspect. So what do you think is the cultural aspect of civil society?
Yeah, cultural aspect to civil society is usually under-theorized, but it exists. And civil society, if we go back to the very beginning, can be defined, roughly defined, as the forms and the space of social life in which people participate in to improve their social world, right? So the goal is to improve the society instead of just, you know, making profits or pursuing self-interest, right? So civil society is mainly about how to make the society a better world, a good society. So central to this concept is that, you know, we need to have some view about what a good society is, what an ideal society is, and then use it as a standard to improve the current society. We're not satisfied with some problems. We need to organize ourselves to solve some problems. But what is the problem that we are addressing, why it is a problem, all depends on our imagination of a good society. So this ideal is the cultural aspect of civil society. Of course, the cultural aspect is broader than the ideal, which I already talked about earlier. It includes other concepts of culture, includes not only values, which is what I'm talking about here, but also how people selectively use those values and ideas in their action, that is culture in action. And also, you know, it includes as a norm of interactions in their activities and also about culture. Objects. So cultural aspect is very central to civil society. It's not a residual concept as some people claim, because if you ask some other scholars, they will say like culture is so redundant in civil society. We need to reduce civil society concept into, let's say, NGOs or, you know, the internet forums and all those specific ones. I disagree with that kind of idea, because I believe if we reduce civil society to these things and we cannot understand why people are joining those activities to improve their society. So the culture aspect is the soul of civil society instead of just a residual concept. And the other scholars also argue that civil society as a concept should be just, you know, eliminated from social and political theories, which I also disagree with, because I believe that, you know, if you get rid of the civil society at all and you are not making your analysis complete, you're making your analysis incomplete, you're losing many, many parts of our society. You cannot understand why people are doing certain things to improve their society. So overall, I believe that cultural aspect is very central to our understanding of civil society in theory and civil society in practice.
Right. And how would cultural sociologists generally empirically look at this culture of democracy?
That's a good question. And also in the introduction, I talked about several approaches to democracy. So one approach is that civil society is all about democracy and it's a very normative judgment. Cultural sociology is not a normative judgment, but it takes normative ideas very seriously and empirically. So in other words, cultural sociology is looking at normative ideas and analyzing why people have their normative ideas and how those ideas inspire and inform people to take some actions. So in other words, cultural sociology is entirely empirical. It empirically examines what culture, which culture and in what ways and how and informs people to participate in civil society. And also what culture is formed. Here, the culture means the interaction norm is formed in their activities. And such cultures may or may not be consistent with the classical view of the culture of democracy in political theory. So it stays a little bit away from normative judgment by saying that, you know, if you look at empirical reality and people understand their actions in very different ways. And some of the ways they understand their actions in civil society might not be in the text of the talk view or in the text of, you know, some Eastern European intellectuals in the 1970s and 1980s. They probably have a very different understandings. And the understanding could be very, quite the opposite to what we expect. So these surprises constitute the heart of cultural sociology of the civil society and also the culture of democracy. In other words, cultural sociologists faithfully stick to empirical facts. So if I can use an analogy, if political theory is the art of speaking, in other words, expressing normative ideas about what the culture of democracy should be, and then cultural sociology is the heart, is the art of listening, that is observing what the culture of democracy actually is, actually works in real world civil society. So this is the fundamental distinction between the cultural sociological perspective and other perspectives and approaches to civil society and the culture of democracy.
We've spoken so much about democracy and civil society, but just to also look at the other picture, do you think that the civil society plays any role in non-democracies?
That's actually the fundamental question that drove me to write this book and other writings as well. So the book is mainly to clarify some of the fundamental issues about civil society and democracy and undemocracy or non-democracy. And I want to say that if you look at media reports and also debates, you find lots of misunderstanding about civil society in non-democracies. Historically, this kind of misunderstanding has its roots in the Eastern Europe and Central European socialism transitioning to democracy, and also the later so-called third wave democracy in Latin America and in Spain and in other places. So it is in this historical moment that people use the term civil society as a way to understand their pursuit of democracy, in which is defined as democratization, as the regime change. And so you have this causal link between civil society actions to democratic transition, to regime change, and the success of Poland, particularly Solidarity, and also the civil society development before Solidarity, gave people sort of a confidence in the small actions, parallel structures, and those societies or publics, counter-publics under authoritarianism. So people begin to romanticize civil society. So this is where we actually started with. But later we found that, you know, if you look at the authoritarian context around the world, there are different ways for civil society to work and act to different ways the civil societies actually exist and work in authoritarian context. For example, you certainly can find some oppositional and contestive associations and individuals under authoritarianism. Muslim Brotherhood, you know, the Polish civil society in the 1970s, and the Tiananmen movement in 1989 in China, and so on and so forth. And also human rights activism as well. So these oppositions are important, but it's not the whole picture. It's not even the biggest part of the picture. If you look at some of the authoritarian contexts, for example, China, the context I'm most familiar with, you find a lot of associations tend to coexist with the authoritarian regime and tend to compromise and negotiate with the authoritarian regime to use the resources from the state and to have the permission of the state for them to exist in that context. So you have those associations who tend to sort of silence themselves about their ideological views and so on and so forth. And also in another tricky part of civil society under authoritarianism is that some associations and organizations are actually the agencies for the authoritarian regimes, the regime implanted them into civil society. And there's a wonderful, but also a funny term, it's called GONGO, government-organized non-governmental organizations. For example, the Red Cross in China, which was supposed to be an NGO, non-government organization, but it was actually a GONGO, a government-organized non-governmental organization, where the staff of the Red Cross was on the payroll of the Chinese state, and the officials in the Red Cross were actually appointed by the Chinese state. And also the honorary president of the China Red Cross was the president of China, now is Xi Jinping. So the GONGOs play the role of the agencies of the regime, try to control the space, try to, maintain the stability of the civil society. And so there's a huge variety of civil society in authoritarian context, and which actually complicates our taken for granted picture of civil society. Again, the main message I will try to convey in this part of the book is to say, like, do not actually assume that every civil society actors are the tank men in 1989 in the Tiananmen protest standing in front of tanks. In other words, they're oppositional, they're defiant. No, that was actually a misleading picture. Many of them tried to survive. Many of them conformed to the norms set by the authoritarian regime. Many of them trying to negotiate with the state, and many of them doing self-censorship, avoiding some of the most sensitive topics, and so on and so forth. So there's a huge variety in there. So I want to try to play out that kind of complexity.
Right. So of course, spoken about it, but if you could also talk a little bit about how community-based organizations play a very different kind of role in such situations, and of course, how associations and individuals also express their participation in civil society when it is an authoritarian state that they are interacting with.
Okay, this community-based organizations in authoritarian contexts are mostly in the relationship of conformity and adherence to the state. In other words, in many contexts, such as in China, they are part of the state system, or they're tightly controlled by the state and they play the function of maintaining the stability or, some administrative functions in the grassroots society. So it's not the community-based organization we imagine in a democratic context that it actually is sometimes against the central state. So that was the part of the situation in the authoritarian context we need to take into consideration. But in those authoritarian states, we need to have a better understanding about individuals' actions and their choices and options and when they're interacting with an authoritarian state. As I already said a few minutes ago, that's some people choose to conform, some people choose to negotiate, but certainly you still have some people choose to interact with an authoritarian state in a defiant way. And sometimes even under the seemingly gloomy sort of picture of the dominance of the state, you find people who actually want to take the risk, want to have their voice heard. For example, a few months ago in China, you probably heard from the news that there was a large wave of surprising protests against lockdown, the so-called zero COVID policy, right? A younger generation of Chinese people took to the streets and to protest against lockdown. Some people even generalized the issue a bit into some political issues and to question the legitimacy of the Chinese state. So what actually drove people to do that? And it's a question for us to think about. What's their idea? What actually is the social basis for those people? It's not just the bravery. It's also has its social foundation in some of the society. Some of the things are pretty clear, although we need a lot of data to do this kind of research. This younger generation, as I mentioned in other interviews with the media, is that they're more global. They're very connected to the outside world. Some of them are overseas Chinese students. So this time you find the connections between overseas Chinese people and also domestic Chinese people. They're protesting pretty much at the same time and share information through social media. And they actually have pretty coordinated actions in many places. Sometimes you'll find a live stream, sort of a reporting. So the citizen reporting of the protests in China and on Twitter and so on and so forth. So this generation is very global. And the regime was not really prepared to deal with this generation. They were surprised and shocked by their daring spirit, and they were not really prepared to understand, or they basically failed to understand why people are dissatisfied, why so many students or younger people just want to take the risk and to chanting those pretty shocking slogans. So this is a way for us to understand. So the previous scholarship on civil societies, on the authoritarianism, tend to correct the older Eastern Europe scholarship by saying that, look, now if you look at authoritarianism and the civil society, you find that most civil societies are more in the relationship of compromise and negotiation with the authoritarian states. They don't want to take to the streets. And now we need to re-examine this concept. Of course, it needs a lot of research.
Right. Last question. What is the global civil society that you refer to, and how does it operate in the contemporary world?
I believe to some extent, every nation state-based civil society now is a global civil society because we are living in a global world. But in the book, I define global society in a more specific way. It refers to the actors, processes, and also institutions and discourses, communications beyond national borders and between different nation states. For example, international NGOs, and volunteers who travel to another country to do their work, and also international networks of organizations, and more importantly, cultural values and ideas, practices about people as residents of the whole world instead of citizens of nations. So this is how global society operates in contemporary world. For example, when we are talking here in this podcast, it's part of the global civil society is the public sphere, right? We are talking about democracy. We are talking about civil society and pressing issue around the world, which is not even imaginable maybe 20 years ago. And we do not have this technology to do that. We rely on traditional media, and the traditional media have more gatekeepers. Now, if you are diligent enough, you do podcasts and invite important people and scholars and even ordinary people to talk about issues, and which is more pervasive in this global public sphere. So we are in a more global world. Therefore, I believe that every understanding of civil society today need to be globalized, even if your subject is within a national a nation-state territory, we still need a global perspective to understand what is going on in particular countries.
Well, thank you so much for this very engaging conversation and for giving me the time and opportunity to engage with this very important book. I hope that our listeners actually go back and pick up a copy and read it. So thank you once again.
Thank you very much.